Blog Talk Radio. Coming live to you with his breaking news.
Breaking news. Unruly passenger beaten with wine bottles by Russ Niles. Crew members and passengers aboard a Delta Airlines flight from Seattle headed for China Thursday evening weaponized wine bottles and anything else they could think of to subdue a young passenger who was hell-bent on opening a galley exit door. According to an FBI affidavit, Joseph Hudek IV, 23 years old, was finally subdued after a wild melee involving several crew members and passengers. At one point, a flight attendant smashed two full wine bottles over Hudek's head, but he shook that off as the Boeing 767 crew made a U-turn over Vancouver Island and headed back to SeaTac. Hudek does not seem impacted by the breaking of a full-liter red wine bottle over his head, the FBI agent wrote, and instead shouted, "Do you know who I am?" or something to that extent. See more on Newsletter Online 2017.
Can you believe it?
And then Roger. Frontier Airlines Incorporated is taking Miami International Airport into new territory with flights to 9 cities, 5 of which are not served by any other carrier at the airport. The Denver-based ultra-low-cost carrier this week announced its expansion at Miami and the return seasonal flights starting in October. Frontier will fly to Buffalo, New York 3 times a week, Cincinnati 3 times a week, Cleveland 3 times a week, Detroit daily, Islip, New York daily, Milwaukee daily, Providence, Rhode Island daily, San Juan, Puerto Rico daily, and Trenton, New Jersey daily. You can see the other flights on Newsletter Online 2017.
Delta Airlines received first A350-900 from Airbus by breaking travel news. Delta Airlines has taken delivery of its first A350-900 and will be the first U.S.-based airline to operate the newest member of Airbus's leading wide-body family. The A350-XWB will bring unrivaled eco-efficiency and a superior passenger experience to primary Trans-Pacific routes starting in October. This delivery is the first of 5 A350-900s scheduled for delivery to Delta in 2017. The aircraft features 32 seats in the Delta One cabin, 48 seats in Delta Premium Select, and 226 seats in the main cabin. The A350-XWB was the first aircraft to incorporate the innovative passenger experience elements collectively known as Airspace by Airbus. Delta's customers will enjoy the quietest twin-aisle cabin with more personal space and the largest overhead bins in the business. See more on Newsletter Online 2017.
Breaking news. Passengers say JetBlue removed them from their flight after their one-year-old kicked seat. It's by Jeffrey Cook. JetBlue is disputing family members' characterization of an episode that prompted their removal from a June 21st flight and said it was considering barring the family from flying with the airline. Though a press release from their attorney, Tamar Rama and Mandy Eifert, were returning home to New York from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with their three children when their one-year-old Eden began to kick the seat in front of them as the plane was about to depart. The statement said Eifert, the female passenger in the seat, exchanged a few words before the woman moved to an empty seat next to her. According to the family, Eifert apologized, and the passenger, but a flight attendant nevertheless asked the pilot to return to the gate, and the family was removed from the flight. See more on Newsletter Online 2017.
Hello, Eastern Airlines family. It's time for the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We're heard in many areas around the United States and around the world. We're listened to over 40 countries around the world. We're adding news items like breaking news at the beginning of our show. Let us know your thoughts about this small change in the broadcast format. My name is Jim Hart. And along with our other hosts, we're glad you're with us. The show is for you and about the Eastern family and Eastern Airlines. Our producer, Neil, says, hey, this is kitchen table radio. And that's where I am right now. I'm at my kitchen table radio on the island of Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. Just as a reminder about how to go about signing into the show and call in if you have any comments or if you want to join the host, is all you need to do. Go to www.ealradioshow.com and look for the radio icon on the home page. Click the arrow in the circle at 7 p.m. and you can listen on your computer. You can also tune in by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. This site is the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio. Now there's an easier way. Just call 213-816-1611 at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And you can listen in right over your telephone. You can also join in the conversation by just saying, hey, hi, since you're already on your phone. We want to hear from you. Neil, how about getting the episode in the air with a new Eastern airplane, the Boeing 727-200. I've got the last bag loaded, Captain Banks. You've got 550 pounds total of airmail. It's loaded within the center of gravity range. Your flight tonight is from Atlanta to Richmond via Spartanburg, Greenville.
Okay, Ben. Me and my squirrel intend to make all stops on time. Looks like the weather is holding for us. Oh, by the way, who's coming south tonight?
According to the teletype, it's Captain Gene Brown. You should be in Richmond when he arrives.
Okay, let's clear prop. Squirrel, hop in my jacket and we'll all be set. PA-5 mail wing. When in February of this year, 1927, Pitcairn Aviation Incorporated was awarded the contract for the operation of the New York-Atlanta overnight airmail service by the Post Office Department, attention was turned to the type of airplane most suited for this service. As a result of an extremely careful survey, both of the geographical and meteorological conditions along the route, together with an investigation of the proportions of business likely to be obtained, it became very evident that an especially designed machine would be necessary with all the requirements, maximum extent, reliability, and operation. In the factory incorporated at Bryn Alpin, Pennsylvania. The machine was designed with full recognition of the fact that at least during the early stages of the development of the New York Atlanta airmail service, the mail load was limited. At the same time, since it operated entirely at night, and in view of the nature of
are we having problems hearing Bill Joseph?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bill, we've got problems hearing you, so I'm going to finish the last part. The PA-5 is equipped with a Wright Whirlwind 3.5C air-cooled engine at 200 horsepower, and the machine has a high speed of 136 miles per hour. Wow. And it has a radius of approximately 600 miles at a cruising speed of 105 miles per hour. The landing speed of the plane is around 45 miles per hour, which, it will be seen, represents a very commendable speed range. In spite, however, of this high performance, the mail wing easily carries from 500 to 600 pounds of mail or express in a mail compartment, the cubic capacity of which is 26 cubic feet. In its original design, the mail wing provides no accommodation whatsoever for passengers, although the characteristics of the machine and the locality of the mail compartments lend themselves to modification for the carriage of two passengers.
The construction part, the general construction of the PA-5, follows standard Picard practice: the fuselage, tail unit, undercarriage, structure being entirely of welded steel tubing. As has been customary in recent Picard construction, the longerons of the fuselage and the cross members of the engine bulkhead and wing attachments are of square section steel tubing. This material is a development of Picard's engineering division. It's approximately 1 inch square in section with round corners and has a great advantage of materially simplifying the process of welding, both from the standpoint of welding operation itself and in lining up. The fuselage structure is based on the Warren truss system, round section tubing being used for cross members at all points except those already mentioned. The Whirlwind engine, with all its accessories, including a 5-gallon oil tank, is mounted on a separate square tubular structure arranged to fit into four sockets on the forward extremities of the main fuselage, with gasoline and oil lines arranged for quick disconnect. It is thus.
The wing structure consists of four wing panels in the center section, the lower wing attachment to fittings on the lower longeron, while the upper wings are attached to the wing center section supported on struts from the upper fuselage longeron. An interesting feature of the wing construction is a complete bonding, which has been carried out with a view to safeguarding the airplane from the dangerous effects of local discharges in the event that the machine should fly into an electric storm. In addition, the bonding of the plane renders the machine suitable for radio installation at such time when there is a demand for this equipment on the airmail line. The bonding is carried out by means of thin strip copper, which connects every metal fitting throughout the entire wing structure with the center metal fuselage by a perfect electrical contact. In consequence, every metal fitting in the entire machine, in spite of its being isolated by the wooden structure of the wing, is actually in complete electrical contact with the engine and fuselage of the airplane. The tail group of the male wing is constructed throughout of welded steel tubing of 5/16 of an inch by 0.035-inch tube, serving as ribs and is fabric-covered. The stabilizer is, of course, adjustable in flight from the pilot's cockpit. The undercarriage of the original plane was a normal V-type with through axle, although in subsequent models, a split axle type is fitted. The undercarriage struts are of streamlined, heat-treated chrome molybdenum tubing, the axle being sprung with normal rubber shock absorber cord. The split axle undercarriage incorporates wheels fitted with brakes. Designed primarily for night flying, the Pitcairn male wing is fully equipped with navigation lights on the port and starboard wingtips, and on the tail, while large, high-powered landing headlights are fitted to the lower wing at the interplane struts.
I got some specifications here on the male wing. This come right out of the 1927 Pitcairn manuals. The general details of the Pitcairn male wing, together with its performance, is given in this following table. The empty weight was 1,612 pounds. And then when they figured the batteries in, the landing lights, and the parachute flares, it got the weight up to 1,742 pounds. Now, it was equipped with these flares. They were parachute type. So if they had a forced landing at night, they could pop the flare. I think they had three of them, and light up an area and possibly make a landing and walk away from it. Now, on our Martin 404s, as I remember, as a new co-pilot, we had flares on it, and they were on the co-pilot's side on the aft part of the panel. That's just a little trivia about the Martin I remember. The total weight on this Pitcairn, 2,512 pounds. That's the max with all the mail, the pilot, and all the fuel on it. Wing area, 252 square feet. Wing section, overall span, 33 feet on the upper wing. The lower wing was a little bit 30 feet. This is a biplane, you know, wing up above and wing below. Okay, the overall length, 22 feet. And then it mentions the cord here, 54 inches on the lower wing and 45 inches on the upper. Now, the cord is an imaginary line drawn from the leading edge of the wing back to the trailing edge. And I guess the only people interested in that would be an aeronautical engineer designing a new wing. And it has a mean aspect ratio of 7.42. This is dividing the overall length of the wing by this cord. the dihedral, when the upper wing was 4 degrees, the lower wing was 4 degrees, and this was for added stability. It would fly hands off a little easier. If you all remember our Martin 404, it had a lot of dihedral. Rather than 4 degrees, it had about 10 degrees dihedral, and this dihedral started just outboard of the engines. But it was a stable airplane, whereas the old Convair 440s we had a straight wing. A little harder it was to, you had to stay at home with it. Proceeding on here, flip the page. The stagger was 22 inches. Now, the stagger is the difference between the leading edge of the wings, the upper and the lower wings. And the upper wings, the leading edge is 22 inches ahead of the lower wing leading edge. Now, this was engineered so the pilot would have better visibility ahead and downward, such as when he's landing. And it goes on to give area of stabilizer 15 square feet plus area of elevators 14.5 and 4.2 square feet on the fan, and area of the rudder was 6.4, and they give the high speed of 136. It was more like its cruising speed was more like 120 to 122. Minimum speed, I guess that would be the stall speed, just above the stall speed, was 45. That was mentioned earlier. And it was possible to change this entire power plant with only 4 bolts, and I guess you could do it pretty quickly. Now, immediately back of the engine in the fuselage structure is a 60-gallon welded aluminum gasoline tank, and it was placed in such a position that it would gravity feed. The fact is, of more than passing interest, since in spite of the fuel tank being mounted in the fuselage where all weights are centralized, the feed is by gravity, a system which is commendable for survivability. A safeguard against firing in the air, the pressure pyrene fire extinguisher is installed, and it has special nozzles distributed along the backside of the engine so as to cover all the vital parts in case of a fire. The operation of this propulsionary system is controlled from the pilot's cockpit. And just a little note here, all of our piston-fired propeller airplanes had a system where we could fire some kind of fire retardant into the engine compartment. And also in the case of Martin 404, where the cabin heaters was in the leading edge of the wing next to the fuel tank, incidentally, there was, you could flood that with CO2.
The mail compartment is located in front of the pilot's cockpit and extends under the gasoline tank. The floor of the compartment is formed of 3 ply wood with a covering of 0.035 gauge duralumin sheeting. And the sides of the compartment are formed of 0.051 duralumin sheeting. An aluminum cover had quick release clips, and that forms part of the engine cowling. This disposition of the mail load ahead of the pilot was convenient, for it was so close to the center of gravity of the machine that regardless of the quantity of the mail they carried, the movement in the center of gravity position was just a little more than 1 inch. Furthermore, by an extremely careful attention to detailed design, the entrance to the mail compartment was arranged so there was no interference of any kind whatsoever with the loading or the removing of the mail bag. The wings, the disposition of which provide excellent visibility for the pilot, are a fabric-covered wood construction, the main and rear spars being of spruce members, while plywood is used very largely in the construction of the rib, has been given to lightness without any sacrifice of strength or rigidity. In fact, a load factor for the entire machine as high as 7.5, which is more than that specified by the Department of Commerce for airplanes of this type, has been maintained, one of the objects being to permit the maximum use by the pilot of the excellent maneuverability qualities of the PA-5.
I've got a few more notes here on the Pitcairn mail wing, and this was a personal experience, and this happened in 1978. Eastern Airlines decided to have a 50-year anniversary program, and they rolled this one of the original mail wings out of the museum up in Fredericksburg, Virginia. It was the Shannon Air Museum. That's where they had one located at that time. And they redone all the original airmail routes from New York to Atlanta. And also they had celebrations on down all the way, all the major stops, all the way to Miami. And this, again, this Pitcairn, I don't remember the tail number on it, was taken out of the museum and blown up to Newark, and then they started the celebrations. Every other day or so, they move on to another city. But anyway, one day I come in from a flight, 727 trip into Atlanta, and a note in my box that said, "Come in and see me." It's the chief pilot, Paul Kelly. I immediately thought I was probably in some kind of trouble, but I went in, and Paul said, "I need a favor. I know you got an airplane. They need somebody to escort this Pitcairn in the Atlanta airspace and out again. And what we'd like for you to do is to go to Greenville Spartanburg the night before and escort him all the way into Atlanta and out again toward Jacksonville." Now, the Pitcairn had no radios, no communication whatsoever. So it was strictly a formation flight. So the night before, I flew up to Greenville and met the pilot. His name was Merton Meade, and he was quite a guy, a real tall guy, and dressed like a World War I fighter pilot, boots and all. And we had dinner that evening, and another person there you might remember, Dick Merrill and Lynn Foley. So that was a real pleasure of mine to have a dinner with these two renowned gentlemen. But anyway, the next day we cranked up and he flew my right wing and I escorted him into Atlanta. And they had a big celebration going when we taxied in toward the hangar. All of our, each one of our airplanes was there and this Pitcairn taxied right in the middle. And anyway, I got an attaboy from Colonel Borman out of it. He gave me a nice letter in my file, which later on I had to use as a marker, and I had a little disagreement with the chief pilot at that time, Wayne Hankler. Anyway, I pulled that letter out of the file, and that got me out of a bad letter from him. So I've got a little more to tell you about the departure of Atlanta, but I'll get off from now and see how the time goes.
Well, that's all we have for the PA-5, but we can say that the Smithsonian at that time, now it's the National Aerospace Museum, thought enough that Eastern.
I think it was in Shannon Air Museum at that time.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about Paul Garber, that was the curator of the Smithsonian. And by the way, REPA had him as a guest to speak at their REPA convention, and he told a story about that. But they placed that Pitcairn, the importance of that airplane to the carrying of mail and getting communications quicker than by rail or car or however that was done before that, horse, I guess, and buggy. But the PA-5 mail wing was ordered by many airlines from the Pitcairn Corporation in Pennsylvania. I guess they made a lot of money on that airplane, and it's proudly presented with the Eastern colors because it was an Eastern airplane, recovered and restored. Do you know anything about the restoration of the airplane that's in Smithsonian Esten?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I've
it
heard
was
a
newer for
it.
A long time.
Yeah, Jim Holder, what was that?
I was saying it was in Newark for a long time, back in a hangar, and they took the wings off of it and drug it up there one Sunday morning real early. That's what I've been told. But it stayed in Newark for a long time, you know, dust covered.
Well, I think Eastern employees did the complete restoration of that airplane.
Yeah, that's true.
And it was given to the Smithsonian. Proudly was there. A good friend of mine went up visiting Washington and all the museums, he and his daughter, and Emery Martinelli. And he proudly came back after his visit up there and said, guess what I saw hanging from the ceiling of the National Aerospace Museum? And he commenced to tell me about the Eastern Air Transport at that time, or Pitcairn, PA-5 male wing, a beautiful, beautiful airplane. What a wonderful airplane. I should tell you, that the information for what we presented about the Pitcairn PA-5 male wing was taken from the September 1927 official house organ of the Pitcairn Company newsletter titled News Wing. And a lot of the information that we present on our show is right from Pitcairn or Eastern Air Transport or Eastern Airlines material. And so we could get a lot of this from Wikipedia, but we chose instead to use the material that Pitcairn presented in its newsletter to its employees about how the Pitcairn is built. And it obviously was a very successful airplane. Any other comments that anyone wants to make about that airplane?
This is Chuck. Do you know how many Eastern had?
Yeah, I did. And right now the number is escaping me, but I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think there was 115 built that all carriers used. I mean, that was a total number produced for different carriers, and the number that we have, golly, I wish I had my book right here in front of me, but Chuck, I knew I'd get stumped tonight. You did it. Okay. But we probably had more than 20 of them, I would imagine.
You know, it seemed like this was the airplane to have back then.
Yeah, it was. And just to keep in mind, Eastern actually continued on the success of the East Coast operation from New York down to Miami. And it was because of the pioneering of the mail wing from New York all the way through with the many, many stops to Miami. And
yes.
So a great airplane.
Summer of 1978.
Yeah. 1978, what was that for, Esten?
Well, that was the 50th anniversary of Eastern Airlines.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Very good.
I had a conversation in Atlanta that I assisted in.
Yeah.
Now, I escorted him out of Atlanta because I had the radio and he had nothing. And I remember on takeoff, he was on the right side of the runway and I was on the left side and he was slightly behind me. And during the takeoff, he accelerated faster than me and actually got ahead of me and got in the air before I did. But then I immediately caught him once we got in the air.
Now,
Esten,
what kind of airplane were you in, Esten?
Oh, I had a stock 172 with an 0350 engine, 0320 engine. It would go about 120, but I had to throttle back. He wasn't too fast. That 136 might have been going downhill, but he didn't cruise that fast.
Yeah.
But anyway, when he come by me on that takeoff, he had no shielded ignition, of course, and he just raised cane with my radios. I couldn't hear nothing. I escorted him down about Macon, and he went on toward Jacksonville, I guess. Somebody down there escorted him, you know. It was quite a thrill for me.
Yeah. My partner is showing me pictures of the airplane hanging from the ceiling, and what a beautiful sight. And I think it's when you first walk in, you almost automatically see that airplane.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to keep Eastern Airlines right out in front of people that still see it today and remember. Well, don't remember the airline, but great to have that display. And now we've got another remarkable airplane we want to talk about, the two airplanes that are in the Smithsonian. I keep saying the Smithsonian because, golly, Pete, they've got airplanes out at Dulles, and I forgot what they call that extension of the National Air and Space Museum. But they've got tons of airplanes. And
Dale Hazy down in Dulles.
Yeah, what's the name of the museum there?
Udale Hazy.
Okay, named after someone, obviously.
Yeah, that someone donated them all the money to build it. Udale Hazy.
He got the money. He's got the name on it.
Quite a few million.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk about that other beautiful airplane, and perhaps you've probably flown that airplane too, Eston, as well. I know Steve Thompson did, but we want to start off with the stewardess. We didn't have stewardess. Well, we did have stewardesses back in the day of the DC-2. So, Linda Fuller, as a stewardess, I want you to start off.
Okay. Captain Steve, I just did a head count, and it looks like we have 21 passengers for our flight to Birmingham tonight, and 10 of them will be in the sleeper compartment.
Thanks, Linda. We'll try to make a smooth landing all the way to Corpus Christi so we do not wake them. Can't guarantee the co-pilot's landing, though. Jim?
Yeah. Captain,
the DC-3.
Okay,
here
we're
going
to start the engines.
Okay, go ahead.
Jim Holder, how about taking
Douglas DC-3. The development of the Douglas DC-3 was brought about by the commercial airlines' demand for an economical passenger carrying airplane. Up to 1934, airline passenger crafts were too slow and carried too few passengers to be really profitable. United Airlines had ordered 60 of the new Boeing 247s, the first truly modern airliner, and had effectively tied up production. The 247 carried 10 passengers at 160 miles an hour and made all the other transports obsolete. The other carriers were thus forced to find another airplane if they wished to be competitive in the passenger carrying business. Now, in 1933, the Douglas Aircraft Company designed a new passenger airplane ordered by Transcontinental and Western Airlines, later known as TWA, to compete with the Boeing 247. The first model, the DC-1, was soon succeeded by, of all things, the DC-2 and the quality of quantity production. American Airlines at that time was using the slow Curtiss Condor, which was fitted with sleeper berths. American needed a new airplane able to compete with the DC-2 and the Boeing 247, but one with sleeping accommodation. In 1935, C.R. Smith, the president of American Airlines, made a direct request of Douglas to build a larger, more comfortable plane which could lure the luxury trade. And on December the 17th, 1935, the Douglas Sleeper Transport, also known as the DST, made its first flight. The original plane was designed as a super sleeper with seven upper and seven lower berths and a private forward cabin. I bet there was a lot of frisky cabins that have been newlyweds on their honeymoon to Corpus Christi with Captain Steve. Anyhow,
Mile High Club.
The day plane version known as the DC-3 had 21 seats. And what's a private compartment anyhow on an airplane? The day plane version known as the DC-3 had 21 seats instead of 14 berths. The honeymooners had to sit in chairs. The design included cantilever wings, all metal construction, two cowled right SGR-1820, 1,000 horsepower radio engines, retractable landing gear, and trailing edge flaps. The controls included automatic pilot and two sets of instruments. If it had an automatic pilot, why didn't Captain Eddie put it on the other airplanes back then? But anyhow, the original design was so satisfactory that basic specifications would never change. American Airlines initiated DST for the honeymooners, nonstop from Chicago to New York, New York to Chicago, on June 25th, 1936, and in September started service with a DC-3. A year later, with a DC-3 in service, Smith stated, "It was the first airplane in the world that could make money just by hauling passengers. This was the beginning of a mortal airplane known the world over as the success of the DC-3 with its larger capacity for passengers, its speed, and its economical operation was realized by the airlines throughout the world started placing orders with Douglas."
In the United States, the big three transcontinental lines were very competitive. With the advent of DST, coast-to-coast service by American Airlines, Transworld Airlines obtained DSTs and DC-3s for such flights also. When the United Airlines, with its Boeing 247s, saw that the Douglas plane was outclassing its own service, the company purchased 10 DSTs and 5 DC-3s and began flights on January 1, 1937. In July of the same year, United introduced sleeper service between New York and California. By 1938, 95% of all U.S. commercial airline traffic was on DC-3s. 260 DC-3s, 80% of the number of airliners, were in service in 1942 on domestic carriers. As of December 31, 1969, 30 DC-3s were still being used by U.S. airlines. Foreign companies also began to order the economical Douglas-built plane. KLM was the first European airline to own and operate DC-3s in 1936, followed by companies in Sweden, Switzerland, France, Belgium, and elsewhere. By 1938, DC-3s were flown by 30 foreign airlines, and by 1939, 90% of the world's airline traffic was being carried by these aircraft. The impact of the DC-3 was felt the world over. In July 1936, President Franklin D. Roosevelt presented Donald W. Douglas, head of Douglas Aircraft, with the Collier Trophy, recognizing the DC-3 as the outstanding twin-engine commercial plane. The citation read, "This airplane, by reason of its high speed, economy, and quiet passenger comfort, has been generally adopted by transport lines throughout the United States. Its merits have been further recognized by its adoption abroad, and its influence on foreign design is already apparent."
Bill,
hey,
Joseph, are you still with us?
Bill?
Well, Bill,
I'll read it if you want me to.
Yeah, go ahead, Jim. Go ahead and read that part.
In 1939, the DC-3 was called on to aid the military fleets of the world. Many commercial carriers in Europe put their DC-3s to use as military transports. The United States ordered new versions of the DC-3 modified for troop transport and cargo carrying. These were designated as C-47s and C-53s. As military versions were built, they were put into operations in European and Pacific theaters using World War II C-47s, initiated in the Berlin airlift in 1948. In military service since 1941, the C-47 proved most useful in many endeavors. Many names and numbers were assigned to the DC-3. England labeled it the Dakota or DAC. American pilots during World War II called it the Sky Train, the Sky Trooper, Dove, or the Goody Bird. The U.S. military official titles were C-47, C-53, C-117, and R-4D. The airlines called it the 3. Of all the names, the affectionate title Goody Bird lingers on. The normal gross weight of the aircraft was 25,200 pounds with 21 passengers. Many times these weights were exceeded as conditions required. The normal range was 1,500 miles. This could be extended by adding fuel tanks. The cruising speed varied from 155 to 190 miles an hour, depending on the load carried and the power used. The DC-3's safety record was better than that of most airplanes, primarily because of its great structural strength and efficient single-engine performance. Since 1935, 803 commercial transports and 10,123 military versions have been built. In addition to about 3,000 have been constructed under license in Russia. They call it the Li-2, and almost 500 in Japan. In service since 1936, the DC-3 is still in use throughout the world. And I might add that in the summer of 1955, my first airplane ride was at a Mississippi Air National Guard C-47. And I thought then that this is the greatest thing that I've done. I didn't think it would get any better than that, but it did.
the meals got better too, didn't they, Jim?
Yeah, they did that. I got a question when this is all over. I got to ask a question, but I don't want to interrupt y'all right now.
Okay, well, we're going to finish the DC-3 with the final notes. You know, as the editor, which right now Jim Holder is doing a fantastic job of being the editor of the Repartee magazine of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. But when I took over from Bill Malone back in 1999, I think it was, one of the covers of the issues that I was the editor of had the picture of the DC-3 that is in the National Aerospace Museum on the cover. And that was, I was proud to present that because our convention that year was in Washington, D.C. And the picture displayed not only the DC-3 going down, it looked like to me Pennsylvania Avenue with the wings off, of course, at night, and the Capitol Dome in the background. Beautiful picture. And I just thought that was appropriate for our convention at the time of REPA. But Arnold Taylor of the Washington Evening Star made this nostalgic picture that was shown. And in 19 years, this Eastern Airlines DC-3, number 344, became a legend which is to be perpetuated in the new National Air Museum as a gift of the company. A veteran of 8.5 million air miles, the venerable transport is shown in the shadow of the Capitol Dome, being towed to storage in Suitland, Maryland, until the new museum building is completed. When finally exhibited, the partially dismantled craft will be restored to the entity which served millions of Eastern Airline passengers. The DC-3 displayed in the Hall of Air Transportation made its last commercial flight on October 12, 1952, when it flew from San Salvador to Miami. By then, it had flown more than 56,700 hours. The DC-3 has proved itself the most popular transport airplane ever built. Dr. Paul Garber, the historian emeritus of the Air and Space Museum of the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., and the speaker at the 1981 REPA convention held in Denver, Colorado, made these remarks in the October, November, December 1981 issue and quoted Dr. Garber. I remember when Captain Eddy came to Washington in a new Connie. I went to see him then and to see the new Connie. I said, Captain Eddy, you're giving up DC-3s. He said, yep. Well, I would like to have one museum. All right, the captain said. I said, will you pick me out a good one that has a real interesting history? Yep, he said. I went back to my office, and there was a letter from American Airlines saying, we were the first to use DC-3s. I went back to see Captain Eddy later and told him that I wouldn't need a DC-3 from him, as American Airlines had one for us. The hell you say, Captain Eddy remarked. Go to the museum now and see Fly Eastern Airlines. It's the biggest advertisement they have for miles around. Captain Eddy was the one who gave it to us. And Captain Gene Ramsey flew the DC-3 to Washington, 1951, to be displayed for millions of people who have seen her since then. 21 of these giant Douglas planes made up the Great Silver Fleet, which flies daily schedules between New York and Miami, Chicago and Miami, New York, Atlanta, New Orleans, and Houston. Eastern Airlines service between New York and Washington, flying time 80 minutes, is the most frequent airplane service in the world at that time. Information for what we heard tonight was about the DC-3 was taken from the Repartee magazine of the retired Eastern Pilots Association. And that's what we have about the DC-3. Now, Jim, I think you had something else you wanted to add to it.
Well, yeah, it's about that squirrel thing, that Dick Merrill. I know that some of these guys carry tiger cubs and everything else, and, of course, Charlie Marty, an Eastern captain, had a monkey in the cockpit of a Connie, but that's a whole different story. But what's this? Is it Dick Merrill, or who was it? I forgot now that they crank up the engines and go, and I get my squirrel in my pocket. Where did that come from? I never heard that.
Well, that was true. That came from the Eastern Airlines news wing, the Pit Carroll news wing. Back in the day, of course, we didn't have our Eastern publications, but up until the time that Pitcairn sold the airline to Clement Keyes and his group, the early pilots, of course, number one on the seniority list was Gene Brown, and Dick Merrill was somewhere later, not too far after Gene Brown, but Dick first had his first companion flying the Mayo Wings was a lion.
Yeah.
And it was a cub to begin with, but it eventually outgrew the cockpit for he and the lion at the same time. And so Dick settled for something smaller, and that was a squirrel. And he kept that little squirrel in his pocket. And the squirrel wouldn't get out of the airplane. It stayed with him. So most it was reported.
It wasn't no Mississippi squirrel. It wasn't no Mississippi fox or gray squirrel, because if I put one in my pocket, it's going to be dead, because those things can bite and claw.
Well, he had names for the two animals that he had. Those are the only two that I can recall that he had flying with him.
Well, I never heard that story before.
Yeah, of course, most folks listening, they don't know the names of Dick Merrill, but Dick was probably the legendary pilot that most all the Eastern people know, and a lot of folks that were outside the Eastern family, because he was married to a beautiful actress back in the 20s named Toby Wing. And Dick, of course, had the celebrity of flying Eisenhower and other distinguished people. And he even made a comment to Captain Eddy. He says, damn it, Captain, he says, every time you get somebody of importance, you always call, I'm the guy to go. He said, can't you find anybody else? But most of these people requested Dick Merrill to be their pilots. That's a matter of fact. So an interesting story about those two airplanes that keeps Eastern Airlines, the name of Eastern, right out there today to people from all around the world going into that display of several airplanes, of course, in Washington, but the one also out at Dulles Airport. I think that's probably, besides the Pensacola Museum, it's the largest museums in this country, at least.
Neil, I got a little comments to do, if you got time for.
Yeah, Aston, go ahead.
You know, they put two different engines on that airplane. The engines we had were the 9-cylinder Wright engines. And the way to tell one of the old Eastern airplanes, we were the only ones that had the Wright engines, the 9-cylinder, one-row Wright engine. And the way you could tell them at a distance was they had no cowl flaps. They didn't put cowl flaps on. Now, all the other DC-3s were Pratt & Whitney's, and they were two rows of 7 cylinders. So you had 14 cylinders on the Pratt & Whitney versus 9 on the right. So if you lost a cylinder on the right, it got pretty rough. But on the Pratt & Whitney, you could lose one or two, and it wasn't too bad. That's what they tell me. I never flew the DC-3. The Eastern got rid of them just a few months before I got hired. And they'd actually retired them a long time before, but when we merged with, I think it was Mohawk Airlines, we merged with one of them up there, and we got some DC-3s, and they kept them a while, and they were in the New York base, but I didn't get to fly them.
So, you mean you would lose a jug and still fly?
Do what, Jim? Hard?
Yeah, I was saying, would you lose a jug and still fly?
Oh, yeah.
If they kept running, you could still
fly with a cylinder inoperative. Yeah, a dead cylinder.
Yeah, but R2800, I saw one taking off on a B-26 in Jack, Mississippi, and he blew a jug halfway down the runway, and he made it all the way around, and about halfway on down when he feathered it, but that engine ran until he feathered it, then he made a single engine landing.
That
was a B-26.
I might make this comment here, and Eston and Jim Holder and any of the other pilots might disagree, but I think the best radial reciprocating engine ever built was the
R2800. Oh, yeah, it was a great engine.
Yeah.
Yep.
It served America well in a war.
Yep.
But, Eston, you keep talking about the right engine. Is there a left engine?
I think they converted them. Didn't they convert those over to Pratt & Whitney engines, Captain?
Yeah.
No, they got converted over.
And, of course, anytime we refer to Wright in aviation, it has to do with the naming of from the Orville and Wilbur Wright, so the Wright Aircraft Corporation.
Neil, on the pit car now, that was a Wright engine also.
That's right, the Wright Cyclone.
The engine that fired Lindbergh, Paris.
Yeah, 200, all 200 horsepower. You talked about, no, that was a pit car, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Which one were you talking about? The pit car? Yeah, it had
that's
Cyclone engine.
To go, guys.
Okay. Any other discussions about Eastern? Is there any other museum that you know of, guys, that display the works of, Eastern airplanes, or I guess maybe the Miami-Dade? The Miami Museum does.
What? Well, I got one more little comment, Neil, on the DC-3 hanging up there at the museum.
Yeah.
I send a letter out to whenever a Eastern pilot dies, if I've got an address, and I'll offer them to have a page or an article in the next magazine, as you well know, to show who they were in the picture and a short article. And it's amazing how many times that when an article comes in, they said, and my dad flew that DC-3 up to to Washington going to Smithsonian. And yeah. I think if that's the case, there's been a lot of times that airplane flown to Washington because so many vehicles right back say, and my dad flew that airplane to Washington. It's hanging yeah. on the wall up there from the ceiling.
Well, I know.
I don't tell them, though. I say, well, I'm proud to know finally you who exactly flew that airplane up there. I'm glad you told me that.
Well, I wonder how many kids Gene Ramsey had. he was the captain that flew the airplane up there. I don't know who his co-pilot was, but I just know captain was Gene Ramsey, and he was, by the way, editor of the Repo magazine as well. He was before Jim and I. Jim Long. Hey, I like that. Jim and I. Jim Holder and myself.
Yeah, Neil?
Yes, sir.
I got one more thing to say about the DC-3, if you got a minute.
Wait a minute, Neil. Before you let Esten keep talking, I just want to say that Captain Fuller sounds really handsome, and his wife sounds beautiful, and they are my parents. And I called in to listen to hear Mom and Dad talk, and I really enjoyed your message tonight. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. And hi, Neil.
Hi.
This is great that you're doing this.
Oh, great, great.
I actually heard a story that I hadn't heard my dad tell before.
Well, I tell you what, Esten has been good for me over the years because he's been my personal chauffeur at Sun and Fun Fly-In.
Well, next to my husband, he's the smartest man I know.
There you go. There you go. Well, he's also a good bartender in the early days of the hangar there.
Well, I don't know about that, Neil. Come on.
Okay.
You know, Neil,
you heard more smart men tonight on the radio show.
Oh, absolutely.
Smart.
Now, Eastern pilots are the best, and if it weren't for Eastern, I wouldn't be here. I always tell people that. It was a great way to grow up. And, Neil, I think you need to do a show with all the Eastern brats and let us come on and tell our favorite stories. Yeah.
Dorothy,
you can sign
you
me
put
up.
That on your
I'll add it to our list.
We'll call it the Eastern brat. The Eastern brats.
Brats. I bet we have some good stories to tell.
Golly.
Eastern brats, still, that'd be something.
We're going to do that. We're going to do that. So put it down, Dorothy.
Okay.
Hey, Neil, that would be me.
You're an Eastern brat, too. That's right. That's right. And it doesn't have to be pilots. Anybody that's a brat of an Eastern employee. That's right. Good.
Boy.
Oh, that was so good. That was a good. We get good callers, especially brats.
I'm probably the oldest brat.
Well, we've had fun tonight, and we want to talk a little bit about upcoming shows and a few announcements that we need to talk about. And we had the board lit up, and I've got all the microphones open now. So before we go into boring stuff, if anyone would like to take this time to get their message out, we'd like to hear it.
I took a ride on a DC-3 2 months ago.
You did? Where?
Yeah.
And what was the purpose?
A friend of mine has a fleet of 3 DC-3s. They're based in Fort Lauderdale Executive. And he flies stuff over to the islands, anything from claws to pigs and goats and everything. Anyway, he had one of them up to, near the little airport south of Daytona Beach, Smyrna, not long ago. And I went over and took a ride with him, and I didn't make the takeoff or landing. I just rode and a little stick time. But anyway, we flew down the shuttle runway. We had permission, and we flew the full length of the shuttle runway at 50 feet. That was quite a thrill, really.
Oh, wow. That's
wonderful. My close call with a DC-3, and I got to fly it, was when I was asked to be the president of a new airline in Key West, Florida. And I was a VP out in Hawaii with a cargo airline. And my instructor, the pilot that did the instructing for me with the airline that I had out there, or vice president of it, his father wanted to start an airline in Key West, and they asked me to help him do that. And first we had to find a DC-3, and I found one in Orlando, Florida, that was an executive DC-3 owned by the Singer Sewing Machine Corporation and other large Fortune 500 companies. I think there were a total of five corporations that had owned that airplane, and it was immaculate. And I got to fly in it, and they got to fly it, and that was my my experience in a DC-3. And of course, I put it in my logbook too, by golly. And but as it turned out, before we started the corporation, the sponsor of the little airline that we were going to start down there died of a heart attack. So it didn't go any further than just me flying a little bit on that DC-3. And almost we were going to buy it, because the price was right and the airplane was right too. And it was configured exactly the way we wanted it. So that was my close call to the DC-3. So now, what else do we have to talk about, Dorothy? You?
Well, I'd like to talk about the REPA convention coming up. Jim Holder, why don't you give us a little talk about the convention and let us know what's going on?
Well, what's going on is we are having people send in their reservations. It's going to be September the 5th in Birmingham at the Hyatt Regency. John Shearer, Captain John Shearer, former captain and check captain at Eastern, is going to be our entertainment for the banquet and possibly for the buffet night also. Big John's real big in country music and bluegrass and all that kind of stuff. He got a band, and that's going to be worth the price of admission right there to see him and listen to his performance. Now, if you're going to make reservations and come, I think you got to look at my calendar here. You've got to call the hotel to get the REPA rate. I'll get my calendar open up here. The last day to get the REPA rate is August the 4th, so that's a couple of weeks from now. So if you're planning on coming, you want to call the hotel and tell them you're coming for REPA, and they'll give you the REPA rate. And tell you the truth, I don't know what it is.
$125 a night, Jim.
Yeah.
How much?
$125 a night.
$125 a night, and they've got free parking because it's part of a mall. But if you want to pay a little extra, you can have valet parking. But I've been there before, and I think it's a pretty safe place, and I don't have any trouble parking, you know, by the hotel in the mall parking lot. But we're looking forward to having a good group, and they still the reservations. If you call and if you send Jerry Frost some money for the reservation, then he'll put you on the list to get a free night, perhaps, if you met the if you're within the first 25. And I don't know,
Jim,
how many have made it yet. Sir?
Jim, we're going to put you over the top, because the president of REPA has approved us, and with your help, Jim Holder, of being there broadcasting our radio show live there in the memorabilia
room. Well, that's good.
Room,
where are you going to do it from, the lobby or something or what?
No, the
you know?
Memorabilia room, according to what talked to Johnny Steinmetz, the president. And I think they've got room in there for us. And so we're going to have a radio show there. And so we invite all folks to come and come to the convention and meet some of the hosts. Don and Dorothy, I think you're planning being there. And I will be there, of course. And we'll have a good time.
Well, is that going to be for one night or every night or what?
We can do it two nights, 2 days. It'll be probably during the daytime. And,
daytime? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Folks you know, have things to do there, and they're
they got so many tours set up and all that stuff. So.
Got a tour each day planned, which will be great.
But it's nice.
Jimmy,
we'll be interviewing
folks
there.
Jimmy,
what do you say, Darcy?
Forgot to mention that your applications are up on your website.
Right. All you got to do is go to repaonline.com, click on the convention tab, and you can print it off as a PDF or a Word document. The instructions and the convention application or registration form, and mail it in with your check, and you might win a free night. I'm glad you're helping me out here, Darcy. I'm not real good on advertising.
Well, we have it up, and you have it on your website, and we also have it up on our website under the news, Reaper News. So if anybody needs information, you get two websites to go to get all the information you need on it.
Yeah, the correct thing to do is call Darcy.
Well, we're glad to help Jim Holder, because you guys are sponsors of our radio show, and we certainly appreciate that. Pass that on to all of the board and the members, and of course we'll be talking about that at the convention because we're on the agenda to tell and give you an update on how the radio show is doing. So we look forward to doing that.
We did make a note that when the episodes go out this week, outlining all the episodes that are coming up on the broadcast each Monday, we have got a note on it there as well, Jim, as a reminder to members to go to your website and see all the information you need for that particular event. So let me tell you a little bit about the upcoming episodes. We have, Neil is back from vacation, so we are having our Thursday program, and that's going to be the nation's first lady chooses Eastern. That should be a great listening. For the episode next Monday will be the wrong airport runway landings, which is going to be very interesting. And the following one on August 7th is going to be airline near collision, successful incident or not. Following that, we're going to have an episode that's going to be great for all of us. It's about the embracing a loved one with Alzheimer's or dementia. It's a must-have to listen to for all of us that are in the senior citizens area. And it's going to have our guest will be Ken Boring. He's the son of the former Eastern Airlines Captain Weldon Lee Boring. So be sure to join us for that as well. On the website, we have the breaking news that we announced tonight. And we also have a lot of reunions that are being planned to go in and check. We have the Era Picnic that's going to be in November, so please go to that news, Era News, and you'll be able to see that picnic information up there. We also have the Bulldog reunion for the maintenance. That also is up under Bulldog. And under the calendar, we have listed quite a few events that are coming up. And as we know, the location, we're also listing that, so be sure to check the calendar out for upcoming events that are happening around. There's a lot of things that are up there that you might be interested in seeing. I have a video up there of the of the Constellation Connie. That's a nice sea, telling all about the Eastern Airlines being one of the first since 1951 to fly the Miami to New York using that particular airline. So we have quite a bit for you, and please go to the website, and if you have anything that you want to send in to us, to be sure to send it to host@ealradioshow.com. We'd be happy to listen to anything that you have to offer. Back to you, Neil.
Well, we talked last week about the radio show posthumously awarding the 2017 Hall of Fame recognition to Captain Steve Thompson, one of our hosts that passed away a few months ago. And the date has not been set yet, but it will be in September or October, and we'll make this announcement on our radio show and a future radio show broadcast and on the website as well. Hope to have the whole family there and a presentation and tribute to Captain Steve, a good friend of mine, and to our host especially, because he really enjoyed working with the crew here, your radio host that bring you this show every week, with the exception of vacation from time to time, but nearly 7 years now. And Captain Steve was with us for most of those years. So we're going to be honoring Captain Steve Thompson. So that's our show for tonight, and I'm going to play some music that Jim Hart would hope to hear. And I think, Jim, you're on
the
air.
I'm here.
Okay. You're here, Jim.
Hey, Landon, Captain Steve, Mr. Producer, another outstanding job on the board. You know, it's always fun when we talk about Eastern Airlines or the Eastern Airlines and the place we work and the stories that we share. We feel we've truly been earned the title of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We feel we've all because of our callers, our listeners, our guests, our host and sponsor, REPA, the Retired Eastern Airlines Pilots Association. We look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us again July 24th when we talk about visiting two Eastern aircraft.
Yeah, well,
the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. Remember, there will be no broadcast on the 17th. Until then, we all say good night, Eastern. We love you, Eastern Airlines.
Good night, Eastern.
We love you, Eastern. Good
night, Eastern. Isn't this great? That no matter what we say, and the terrible writing from your host and producer, we all seem to have some fun and we come back for more. So we look forward to you coming back again next week for another show, which I'm sure you're really going to about pilots landing at the wrong airport. So
okay.
Be on that trip and see where you land up. You wind up.
Good fun tonight.
Thanks, Linda. Good having you.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Jim. Good night, Chuck.
Martha's
good night,
Vineyard. Martha's Vineyard awaits your arrival.
Hey, let's do a Walton show. Good night. Everybody says good night to everybody else.
Thank you.
We used to do that.